KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
American companies will distribute the food directly to Palestinian families. They'll do so in safe zone secured by our military.
Israel is allowing food into restricted areas of Gaza, even as airstrikes increase and hundreds of thousands are displaced. Today is Monday, May 26th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, President Trump calls Vladimir Putin absolutely crazy following Russia's latest barrage on Ukraine.
He's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all.
We'll have the latest from Moscow. Also, how to keep birds from flying into windows. Researchers say the key could be ultraviolet light.
Birds were realizing that there was a barrier there because they slow down and hover and then change direction and leave.
Plus, from rom-coms to blockbusters, from a Karate Kid sequel to a reboot of The Naked Gun, our summer movie preview after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Around 50 people were injured when a British man's minivan plowed into a crowd of people celebrating Liverpool's soccer club win today. Police say 27 were taken to the hospital and more than 20 others were treated on the spot. Four children are among the injured. Jenny Sims, Assistant Chief Constable, says one person is in custody.
The car stopped at the scene and a 53-year-old white British man from the Liverpool area was arrested. We believe him to be the driver of the vehicle. Extensive inquiries are ongoing to establish the circumstances leading up to the collision.
There's no word on a motive, but police say they don't believe this is terrorism. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer thanked police for their quick response and said that his thoughts are with those injured or affected. Tens of thousands of Liverpool fans had come out amid wet weather to celebrate the team. Los Angeles has the highest number of homeless vets in the country. It's also got a massive, nearly 400-acre Veterans Affairs campus in the middle of West L.A. Advocates have fought in the courts and in the streets for decades to use that campus for housing for needy veterans. President Trump signed an executive order that could change everything, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
A lawsuit back in 2011 forced the VA to start building housing on the campus, but it's been slow. On May 9th, President Trump released an executive order that the West LA VA campus will be transformed to house and care for 6,000 homeless veterans by 2028. Iraq vet Rob Reynolds works with homeless vets in and outside the gates.
I'm very thankful that President Trump took this position, that with this executive order, that this is a soldier's home and it was donated for that reason, and that we need to get our veterans off the street.
In the past, VA officials opposed putting so many troubled veterans in one place. But advocates in LA are taking Trump's executive order as a win. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Los Angeles.
King Charles and Queen Camilla are in Canada for a two-day royal visit. Emma Jacobs reports the visit is seen as a show of support for Canada's sovereignty.
King Charles is Canada's ceremonial head of state, and this is his first visit to Canada since his coronation in 2023. The King and Queen Camilla arrived in the capital city of Ottawa and were greeted on the tarmac by Prime Minister Mark Carney, who extended the invitation for this visit. The royal couple participated in a series of public events around Ottawa. On Tuesday, the King will preside over the opening of Canada's latest session of Parliament, a symbolic gesture that is seen as lending support to Canada and its current political order amid talk of possible annexation by President Trump. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In France, angry farmers have joined disgruntled striking taxi drivers united over two separate issues. The farmers are protesting an agricultural bill that deals with regulations around water and pesticide use, and taxi drivers are protesting changes to the fare structure for medical transport. A taxi strike last week blocked hundreds of miles of roads around Paris. Hell's Canyon, which is on the border between Oregon and Idaho, is the deepest river canyon in the United States. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, scientists say they now know how old this canyon is.
At its deepest point, Hell's Canyon goes down almost 8,000 feet. Matthew Morris is with the Utah Geological Survey. He wanted to know the age of this canyon. And to find out, he needed to analyze sand and gravel deposited by the river long ago as it was cutting through the rock.
You're looking for pieces of evidence of where the river used to be.
He and some colleagues went searching inside caves, lots of caves in the canyon walls. And in a few of them, they found ancient river sediments. In the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they say it looks like this canyon got carved 2.1 million years ago. That makes Hell's Canyon surprisingly young, millions of years younger than Arizona's Grand Canyon. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Wall Street was closed today in observance of Memorial Day. U.S. futures contracts are trading higher. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Palestinians are under mass evacuation orders in Gaza. Israel says it plans to capture 75% of the territory and defeat Hamas. Hundreds of people have died in increased airstrikes over recent weeks, and hundreds of thousands more have been displaced. That's according to the United Nations. Israel is allowing food into restricted areas under a new plan backed by the U.S., but the head of that plan just resigned amid intense criticism from aid groups. NPR's Daniel Estrin brings us reporting by NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City.
Another cleanup after another Israeli strike. It hit overnight on a school in Gaza City, housing newly displaced families. Israel's military said it targeted Hamas militants plotting attacks there. A Gaza rescue group says more than 30 people were killed, including at least 18 children. Jamalat Abdelal came running from her tent nearby, trying to help. We found body parts and everyone screaming on fire, she says. Children dead? What did they do? Displacement, hunger, and threat of death hang over Gaza today. Israel restricts food and is greatly restricting where civilians can shelter now, ordering hundreds of thousands to move further south. Gaza City is now a sprawling refugee camp. Its once charming harbor is covered in tents. NPR's Anas Baba meets Sulaf Wishah, who pitched a tent here with her family a couple of days ago. There are flies and mosquitoes feeding on our blood, she says. There's a trap on the floor of the tent to catch the mouse that's been eating the little bread they have, she says. Nearly 600 days into the war, NPR's Anas Baba asks her, describe your feelings. There are no feelings, she says. You wake up and go to sleep to the sound of shelling, eat and drink to the sound of shelling, pray to the sound of shelling. She's 7 months pregnant, but doctors say they can't detect a pulse from her fetus. They say she suffers from malnutrition. Hunger is widespread after a nearly three-month ban on food, medicine, and other supplies. Now, under U.S. pressure, Israel is allowing limited quantities back in a new plan touted by the U.S. that aid groups are criticizing. In a video defending Israel's latest campaign, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Palestinian civilians will have to move south to get food.
American companies will distribute the food directly to Palestinian families. They'll do so in safe zone secured by our military. And this will allow us to complete our goal of destroying Hamas while enabling aid to reach the civilian population.
A U.S.-backed group, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, says it will be in charge of distributing parcels. But the U.S. Marine veteran who headed the group resigned late last night. He says its methods don't follow humanitarian principles. Aid groups say it's wrong to restrict access to aid and to resign a population to mass displacement. At the tent camp on the Gaza port, 62-year-old Majda Dwan says she would move toward one of the newly designated zones to get food because she doesn't see any other choice. She says yesterday, all she ate was a piece of bread and a pinch of salt. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv, with reporting by NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City.
Worcester, Massachusetts, was famous in the 1800s for being the leading producer of wire for the country. Liz Nieslas went to the city to see what's made there now and how today's manufacturers are dealing with shifting tariffs.
At this rail yard in Worcester, I'm watching a hulking freight locomotive on the move. Freight trains still crisscross this city, going over rusting bridges. One bridge near me says, Building America. These trains are mostly connecting goods to the rest of the country, and they're not as critical to manufacturing in this city like decades ago when Worcester was cranking out wire and paper-making machines.
Not far from the train tracks is one of Worcester's newer manufacturers. In an old industrial neighborhood with boarded-up brick mill buildings, Multiscale Systems is designing and making custom parts used for precision manufacturing. CEO Jesse Silverberg purchased an old machining business and invested in high-tech equipment.
Precision metal is precision metal, and it shows up in all sorts of use cases in the manufactured world.
He points out molds for making maple syrup containers and parts needed to make components for nuclear reactors.
This kind of work is an echo of what was being made in Worcester during the heydays.
Economist John Brown has studied the manufacturing history of Worcester, and he sees a business like Multiscale as its future. But he says Trump's tariffs destroy the system they rely on.
You have different suppliers in different countries specializing in producing elements of sophisticated supply chains. And you impose these kinds of tariffs and try to incite a trade war, you're basically assuming that the world doesn't work like it actually does. There's no sense behind it.
Multiscale employee Paul LaValle is at an older machine. He's worked in manufacturing for over 40 years and doesn't think people realize what's changed.
I don't think they always think of how many things it takes to make a product. Things are coming from across the world. Wasn't always that way.
Manufacturing engineer Ray Serro is perfecting a part with a metal 3D printer.
So you have these other alloys that often have a primary component that America might do fine with, but still relying on other countries for that little piece of the puzzle that makes those materials unique. So it's hard to get around that.
There's been plenty of focus on steel and aluminum, but many U.S. manufacturers need another metal, tungsten. 80% of the world's tungsten comes from China. It's essential to many of the tools Multiscale buys. Silverberg shows me an advanced cutting tool made with tungsten.
One of the things that I find myself wondering and worrying about is, are we going to have enough of these?
Silverberg says some customers have put orders on hold, waiting to see where tariffs land. Timothy Murray, CEO of the Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce, says in recent years the city's drawn new companies like biomanufacturing. But tariff uncertainty is throwing a wrench in the works.
There is a real nervousness and I think caution that is taking place among our manufacturers, which is not likely to lead significant growth in jobs at this juncture until there's better clarity on what the end result is here, which is anybody's guess.
To bring manufacturing back to Worcester, Murray says, you need a reliable supply chain. For NPR News, I'm Liz Nieslas in Worcester.
In the U.S., about a billion birds a year die from collisions with windows. Researchers at Utah State want to reduce that number. Utah Public Radio's Clarissa Casper reports.
Utah State's campus in Logan is filled with hundreds of fruit-bearing trees that attract birds, and buildings with large windows offering students a good deal of natural light and stunning views of the Bear River Mountains. But those windows are bad news for birds. Kimberly Sullivan, the campus ornithologist, points to one particularly problematic building, the University Inn.
That could have been a hit right there, that big white streak.
Sullivan says she often gets calls with reports of birds dying after hitting university windows. The inn has received countless reports.
And you can see, oh, you see where there's 1, 2, 3, 4 dots on the window?
Yeah.
That's that when they hit, they leave skin and cells and feather cells. And so those, you often get those little white marks.
She decided to call Mark Coven, a professor of outdoor product design, whose students once built an art installation that had the unintended effect of reducing deaths at another bird-killing building. That installation wouldn't work for the University Inn, but a few years later, Coven had an aha moment for a solution.
When you think about our modern-day glass, it all has UV coatings on it to some degree, and all you have to do is fluoresce that to make it look more solid for somebody who sees in a UV light.
He thought that shining LED ultraviolet lights on the windows coated to reduce UV light would make the windows look like solid objects to birds, not something clear that they can fly through. So they tried it. The researchers installed flagpoles outfitted with commonly available LED lights aimed at the inn's windows. And it worked.
Birds were realizing that there was a barrier there because they stopped, you know, 5 feet away, enough for them to slow down and hover and then change direction and leave.
Between May and November 2023, bird deaths at the inn dropped from 11 a month to nearly zero.
But this was a proof of concept. Could it work?
Yeah.
And it did.
Could a crazy idea from a designer slash artist actually solve something?
But their hastily designed flagpoles were only a temporary fix, created with cheap materials. And the university said they had to come down.
We had to beg them to keep it up as long as we did.
Oh.
To get through one of the really intense collision seasons. But, you know, it was a temporary construction.
The university's Jordy Guth says the school could support the idea if the design could be made more permanent.
That particular sort of mock-up that they had really is not the right thing for anything longer than what they had. But that doesn't mean there couldn't be something else designed.
Now, Sullivan and Coven are trying to find money to design and build something more attractive that still saves birds.
The problem is getting the funding to do the retrofits. Like, the desire is there, but the funding is not.
The pair are also working on publishing their research so they can share what looks like a good solution to them with the wider world. Meanwhile, bird deaths at the inn continue. Sullivan recently received a frantic call, reporting that about 90 birds had hit the windows at once. For NPR News, I'm Clarissa Casper in Logan, Utah.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and Hollywood's blockbuster season is upon us. Tom Cruise hanging from a biplane, Lilo and Stitch wreaking havoc. In his summer movie preview, our critic Bob Mondello says those films are a pretty good indicator of what else is coming.
The miracle of movies is that they can take you pretty much anywhere.
Go towards Barbados, avoid government patrol, but there aren't that many anymore.
Why's that?
No one's dumb enough to go where we're going.
And yet they keep going back.
This island was the research facility for the original Jurassic Park.
Of course it was. Jurassic World Rebirth leads a longer than usual parade of summer's sequels, reboots, and remakes. I'll keep going with the sequels first. They include Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio taking different teaching approaches for a new kid who's being bullied.
Ancient way. Miyagi way.
In Karate Kid Legends, Freaky Friday's body-switching mother and daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, return in Freakier Friday.
Oh, no, not again.
What's happening?
It's all right.
Who's in my body?
It's okay, it's me.
Harp, it's Mom.
Wait, if you're me and I'm you, then who is that?
I'm Grandma, sweetheart.
Horror sequels include one from the team that made the Rage Virus thriller 28 Days Later. They're bringing back Cillian Murphy, their now Oscar-winning original star.
There were so many dead.
In 28 Years Later.
Infected and non-infected alike.
And everyone's favorite murderously protective robot returns in Megan 2.0.
You threatened to rip out my tongue and put me in a wheelchair.
I was upset.
In Ballerina, the world of John Wick will continue with a female assassin, though Keanu Reeves does show up.
I'm not leaving.
Your choice.
Rules.
And consequences.
There are also animated sequels aimed at kids, including The Bad Guys 2.
What was that?
I panicked, okay? I'm a panicker.
And what seems like at least Smurfs 6.
I think I just smurfed my pants.
Different from sequels are reboots, which aim to start franchises over again. Liam Neeson will channel his inner Leslie Nielsen as
Frank Drebin
in The Naked Gun.
The new version.
There's a live-action version of the animated classic How to Train Your Dragon.
Everything we know about dragons is wrong.
And of course, it wouldn't be summer without a couple of superhero reboots. Marvel's hoping a fresh cast will make fourth time the charm for a team that's never really caught on with movie audiences.
Please welcome the Fantastic Four.
And over in DC's extended universe, they're welcoming a new Man of Steel, actor David Corenswet.
Hey, buddy. Eyes up here.
Superman is the first film in what's being billed as a more cohesive and interconnected DC universe. Suppose we'll see about that. And then there are some wholesale remakes, call them homages to genre classics. Spike Lee has reworked Akira Kurosawa's police procedural, High and Low, as Highest to Lowest, starring Denzel Washington.
The hard times will come from the good times, the hard times will come from success, the hard times will come from the money, and the mayhem follows.
And the satire The Roses recasts the marital mayhem of 1989's The War of the Roses with Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman.
You're a bottomless pit of need!
If all this recycling is making you madder, rest assured there will also be original stories like F1, a sort of Top Gun Maverick on wheels, with aging driver Brad Pitt sparring with a hotshot rookie.
When's the last time you won a race?
Sunday, Daytona.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Formula One.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then same as you.
And this being summer, a lot of the new movies are comedies. Say one where Rebel Wilson is her best friend's maid of honor.
You guys, tonight is going to be the best bachelorette party ever. Because it was organized by my oldest friend, Sam!
The problem is, Sam's job keeps getting in the way. She's a secret agent. The film is called Bride Hard. Other films that mix chuckles with chaos, Wes Anderson's latest weirdness, The Phoenician Scheme.
Help yourself to a hand grenade.
About a businessman, his daughter who's a nun, and assorted assassins.
Why are you shooting my ceiling?
This is a robbery on behalf of...
I understand that. I'm asking about my ceiling. You idiots are destroying a magnificent nightclub.
Ethan Coen's small-town mystery, Honey Don't, matches up Detective Margaret Qualley and Pastor Chris Evans.
Why is a private investigator looking into a traffic fatality?
What can you tell me about...
Do you drink?
Heavily. It's a point of pride.
Should you and I discuss this over a drink?
Tuesdays I dry out.
Today is Wednesday.
Today is Tuesday.
In I Don't Understand
Chin,
You,
chin. Chin, chin.
A gay couple adopting a child in Italy,
I can't see a thing, there's no power,
run into problems that go way beyond translation.
Oh my God, it was an accident.
And in Sketch, a Gremlins-ish Jumanji-like fantasy, a dad has to figure out what to do when his daughter's drawings come to life.
You have to promise not to freak out.
I won't.
This is the Blood Eater.
Amber drew that?
She's working through some stuff.
Less mayhem-centered comedies include Ari Aster's satire Eddington, which pits conservative Sheriff Joaquin Phoenix...
People of Eddington like guns.
...against liberal New Mexico Mayor Pedro Pascal...
Fighting the pandemic.
...to mock all sides of the political divide over COVID. Pascal is also in the comic romance Materialists from Past Lives director Celine Song as a guy so perfect that professional New York matchmaker Dakota Johnson can't believe she's found him.
You are what we call a unicorn, an impossible fantasy.
Her ex, played by Chris Evans, is less impressed.
Not gonna marry him, are you?
Why not?
Because he's good looking and rich. Probably doesn't have roommates.
There's also the heartfelt comedy Everything's Going to Be Great, which follows a family as it tries to start a theater company in New Jersey.
Good things are coming, boys. I can feel it in my bones.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's arthritis.
A number of more serious films also focus on family, not always in a positive light. The Western Unholy Trinity, for instance, set in 1870s Montana.
Welcome to Trinity.
Sheriff, my name is Henry Broadway.
That would make your father Isaac Broadway. Let me give you a bit of advice. Keep your ancestry between us. Not every man who's known is loved.
Nor is every woman who's known. Witness the title character played by 95-year-old June Squibb in Eleanor the Great.
Taking a trip, Eleanor?
Moving home, actually. You know, my daughter's been begging me to move in with her for the longest time.
You mean the kid who's hooked on Adderall or the one who doesn't talk to you?
Civil Wars drive the action in two summer dramas. Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight centers on a white family in what was then called Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe.
Mom, am I African?
No, Papa.
Only because we don't have brown skin.
And 40 Acres centers on a black family in a dark dystopian future.
You've heard about the attacks by now?
Thought your Union Army was gonna come and take care of it.
They're not. They're dead.
A theme powering a lot of these movies is the human need for connection. It's looked at darkly in a paranoid thriller about a fan who's angling to befriend a pop star.
What's your happiest memory?
Yeah, probably when I was 18 and when I left home and came here full time and did this, yeah.
Was it scary?
It's called Lurker.
No, it's like, you know, I have a new family now. And I get to choose who's in it.
A horse trainer grieving the loss of her husband creates a safe space for wayward teens in East of Wall.
Now she's got all these kids living out there, teaching them breaking horses.
And a woman who's suffered trauma finds fellowship in Sorry Baby.
We know what you're going through. We are women. What?
And remember we said at the beginning that movies can take you anywhere? Well, Pixar's Elio takes that literally, with a kid who's found a unique solution to feeling alone.
I'm trying to get abducted by aliens.
Elio!
And wouldn't you know, it works.
It's really happening!
We search the universe
for the dreamers and stargazers
like you.
And wouldn't you know, the movies make it magical.
This is the most beautiful place I've ever seen.
This is the bathroom.
I'm Bob Mondello.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has targeted Harvard University, ordering thousands of international students to go home or change schools, also canceling grants in a bid to force the university to accept more federal control. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're in Boston to interview Harvard President Alan Garber. You can see it online or hear it on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, how a presidential assassination gave rise to America's modern civil service.
These people who are professional civil servants, many of whom have been there for decades through administrations, Democratic and Republican, they serve the American people.
Plus, why President Trump is saying Vladimir Putin has gone, quote, absolutely crazy. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Police in Liverpool, England say a 53-year-old man is in custody after he allegedly drove a minivan into a crowd of soccer fans at a parade to honor the city's Premier League team. Police this evening held a news conference where they said that 27 people are hospitalized and authorities say they believe the crash is an isolated incident and not an act of terror. President Trump, Vice President Vance, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth all took part in the wreath-laying ceremony this morning at Arlington's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier outside Washington. Trump paid tribute to veterans who died in America's wars, but as NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports, he later waded into politics.
In a speech following the ceremony, Trump praised the men and women of the military who gave their lives and the Gold Star families that were left behind. After speaking about the first soldiers who died during the American Revolution, Trump took shots at former President Biden's administration.
Their valor gave us the freest, greatest, and most noble republic ever to exist on the face of the earth, a republic that I am fixing after a long and hard 4 years. That was a hard 4 years we went through.
Earlier in the day, in a Memorial Day post on social media, Trump also lashed out at the former administration for its immigration policies and at judges who have blocked the Trump administration's agenda. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
King Charles is in Ottawa on a visit that Canada's leaders say will underscore that nation's sovereignty at a time when President Trump has made repeated calls for the U.S. to annex Canada. Charles will deliver a major address to open a new session of Parliament on Tuesday. The King is the head of state of Canada and 13 other Commonwealth states, including the U.K. It's only the third time a king or queen has opened Parliament. From Washington, this is NPR. Former Democratic Congressman Charlie Rangel, who represented Harlem in Congress for nearly 50 years, died today at the age of 94. NPR's Ava Pukach brings us this remembrance.
Rangel served in Congress from 1971 through 2017. He co-founded the Congressional Black Caucus during his first term. He spoke about that to C-SPAN in a retirement interview.
It was then that we said that collectively we can be a major force of influence rather than individually, and that it would make no difference what part of the country that we came from.
Rangel later became the first black chair of the Congressional Ways and Means Committee. Prior to his time in Congress, Rangel served in the U.S. Army, earning a Purple Heart and Bronze Star in the Korean War. Ava Pukach, NPR News.
A court in Germany convicted four former managers of Volkswagen of fraud, two of them receiving prison sentences for their roles in the manipulation of vehicle emission controls. Today's ruling, came almost 10 years after a scandal erupted over the company's rigging of diesel engine vehicles. This is day 9 in the manhunt for five men who remain on the run after escaping from a jail in New Orleans. Five of the inmates have been captured. Several people are facing charges for allegedly assisting those who escaped. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Over the weekend, Russia launched some of the biggest air attacks against Ukraine since invading more than 3 years ago. Ukrainian authorities say 12 people were killed. And on Sunday, President Trump made clear he was not pleased.
Yeah, I'll give you an update. I'm not happy with what Putin's doing. He's killing a lot of people, and I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him. But he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all.
Well, here to provide some perspective from Moscow is NPR's Russia correspondent, Charles Maines. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So dive right in there with the comments from President Trump. And I will note he went even farther in what he said about this on social media. How is all of this landing where you are in Russia?
Well, just to pick up on your point, you know, on social media, he said Putin had, quote, gone absolutely crazy and was shooting missiles and drones into Ukrainian cities for no reason whatsoever. As to the Russian reaction, well, Moscow insists these attacks were precision strikes, their language, on military-related targets, that despite scenes of apartment buildings destroyed. Moscow also accuses Ukraine of attacking Russia with hundreds of drones throughout the weekend, in other words, framing this as a tit-for-tat. You know, as to Trump's criticism of Putin, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, he essentially took a pass. Let's listen. So here Peskov thanks the U.S. and Trump in particular for what he framed as a meaningful diplomatic efforts towards peace, but suggested that Trump, along with everyone, was experiencing what Peskov called emotional overload from the Ukraine negotiations.
Emotional overload? And then also praising President Trump for his diplomacy? Is that a surprisingly mild response, Charles, from the Kremlin to the allegation that Putin has gone, quote, absolutely crazy?
Well, you know, keep in mind it was just a week ago that Trump and Putin held their phone call in which Trump declared Moscow and Kyiv ready to immediately start negotiating a ceasefire. They have not, and critics accuse the Kremlin of dragging out peace talks as Russia continues to attack Ukraine, arguably with Trump now giving Moscow diplomatic cover. I should note that today Trump threatened new sanctions against Moscow if it didn't stop these attacks. But that's a threat that he didn't back up when Putin was said no to a ceasefire and promised more talks instead. So maybe the way to look at this is Russia's latest attempt of trying to not antagonize Trump, even praise him as Russia feigns progress towards a peace that just isn't there.
Well, and meanwhile, what about Ukraine? Because Ukraine's president, President Zelensky, was also on the receiving end of Trump's ire over the weekend.
You know, he was. Zelensky clearly irritated Trump by calling out the, quote, silence of America as these attacks were unfolding, adding that without truly strong pressure on Putin, this brutality would not stop. Trump appears to have taken this as a dig at his mediation efforts and said Zelensky was doing his country no favors by talking the way he does. What that means, we'll have to see. But either way, you know, this weekend was discouraging for anyone who wants an end to this war.
Indeed. NPR Moscow correspondent Charles Maines. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Now, a story about continuing problems for victims of sexual assault seeking justice in Colorado. And a warning to listeners, it includes details about these types of crimes. The problems have to do with the lab testing needed to process what can be the strongest evidence in sexual assault cases, rape kits. The state has a backlog of about 1,400 untested kits. Colorado Public Radio's Binta Berkland reports.
Miranda Spencer, a 35-year-old mom and business consultant, lives with her young daughter in Denver. A couple of years ago, when she was going through a divorce, she tried a dating app for the first time. After a few uneventful first dates, Spencer agreed to meet a man who'd been persistently messaging her.
So I let a friend know, hey, I'm going to go out. And the exact words that I used were, on this pity date, you can come over afterwards so we can hang out.
Those words ended up being fateful. She said she only remembers the first 20 to 30 minutes of that date. She woke up the next morning with her friend hovering over her asking if she was okay. Her friend told her what he walked into when he came over.
The person that assaulted me was in my bedroom. I was unclothed. I was pretty incapacitated. I had vomit all over me.
The hospital in Denver told her she was drugged with fentanyl. She agreed to an invasive exam by a nurse to attempt to collect DNA evidence. What Spencer didn't know is how long it would take for a lab to process that kit. Wait times had been going up and were about to balloon exponentially. Chris Schaefer, director of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, explains one reason. Allegations that a longtime scientist in the lab had manipulated DNA results.
Because of that, we had to shut down basically 50% of our DNA sciences for the better part of a year to go through and research the over 10,000 cases that our former scientists had worked. That was our number one priority.
Also at that time, a number of DNA scientists were on family leave or had left the job. Wait times for sexual assault kits skyrocketed. Schaefer has apologized to victims, but for Spencer, it's been excruciating.
Waiting, you know, almost a year and a half to have to like fully understand what the worst thing that's happened to you, like all of the details of it, is honestly, it feels like very barbaric.
We start to feel very uncomfortable and concerned when that turnaround time gets above 90 days.
Ilsa Connect is with the Joyful Heart Foundation, a nonprofit based in New York City. She directs their End the Backlog initiative and says it's hard to document how long wait times are across the country. But Colorado's current pace is pretty extreme.
More than a year, its alarm bells are going off. So getting closer to almost 2 years is like a four alarm fire.
This year, Colorado lawmakers set aside $2 million to outsource tests and another million to help with overall issues at the Bureau, including the backlog. For one state lawmaker, it's especially personal. Democratic Representative Jenny Wilford said the evidence from her sexual assault by a Lyft driver went untested for more than a year.
It was really difficult to wait as long as I did and to feel like that result was hanging over me and that I didn't know if there would be DNA evidence or not.
Wilford is suing Lyft. In response, the company said passenger safety is fundamental and that it works with police to investigate alleged crimes. Law enforcement officials say waiting for this evidence prevents them from completing investigations and making arrests. Delays also make it harder to get convictions. As the wait for her evidence stretches onward, Miranda Spencer says she's trying to stay present for her five-year-old daughter.
I need to move forward. I need to not be in this holding pattern. Like, my whole life has stopped because of this.
She got a temporary restraining order against the man she believes assaulted her, but it's expired. She's still fearful of her alleged perpetrator. Spencer's been told she'll get her DNA evidence soon. But after all is said and done, she says she has no expectations she'll ever get justice. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Lawmakers in Louisiana are asking Congress to bring back a federal program that helped schools buy food from local farms. It's one of the cuts the Trump administration made to the Department of Agriculture. Member station WWNO's Aubrey Yuhas explains how one school district spent the money before they lost funding.
It's lunchtime at Northwestern Elementary outside Baton Rouge. Bianca Coates, the supervisor of school nutrition, says the kids love anything with beef.
A fan favorite is beefaroni. Beefy Nacho Day is like an all-time favorite across the district. We also do the homemade meatloaf.
Coates has used two federal programs to buy beef for Zachary Community Schools, which includes Northwestern Elementary. The first provides discount food to schools. The second was a farm-to-school grant. She used that to buy local grass-fed beef.
You can tell that the grass-fed beef is much leaner. It doesn't have as much fat in it.
That beef comes from a small family-owned farm less than an hour away. Muse 3 Farm in Greensburg. On a windy day, dozens of cows are grazing on rye grass.
As long as we have grass, we are happy.
Chris Muse founded the farm with his three brothers. They started selling their high-quality meat at farmers markets and to restaurants. Muse wanted to sell to schools, too.
Kids gonna eat every day at those schools, right? And you would think, okay, well, where are most of their food coming from? Is it coming locally? You know, and the reality is, no.
In the most recent farm-to-school census in 2023, only half of Louisiana schools reported serving any local food. The problem is cost. Muse's premium grass-fed beef is $10 a pound. That discount beef schools buy? That's $4 a pound. That's where the grant program came in. It launched a few years ago under the Biden administration to give schools federal funding they could only spend on local food. Produce, meat, rice. When he heard about it, Muse remembers thinking,
this is what I have been waiting on.
Suddenly, schools had the money to buy his beef.
They were calling me now, said, hey, okay, we're ready. What can you do?
He says demand was so high he had to turn some schools away. He got other farmers involved in the program and planned to expand his operations. But then the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, started making cuts. More than $500 million for schools to buy food from farms disappeared. The Department of Agriculture says the program was no longer in line with the agency's goals. Without that money, Coates with Zachary Schools says she can't afford to buy local beef. Muse, the farmer, says he's heard the same from all his schools. Marlene Schwartz researches food policy at the University of Connecticut. She says it's unfair to expect schools to be able to buy food directly from farms without government support.
To sort of simultaneously, you know, get the best price and have the highest quality, that unfortunately in our food system in the United States, that's just not the way it works.
Back on the farm, Chris Muse says he hopes the Trump administration will realize they've made a mistake.
I'm optimistic that once things settle down and we reorganize and restructure things, I feel that that program is one of the programs that's going to come back.
Some Republican lawmakers in Louisiana are pushing Congress to restore the funding. They say they support the Trump administration's plans to make America healthy again and argue you can't get healthier than farm fresh. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Juhas outside Baton Rouge.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The federal government is the largest employer in the U.S. with just over 3 million civilian civil service workers. These workers are responsible for everything from delivering your mail to making sure your tap water is drinkable. They're hired based on their qualifications and expertise, and they're supposed to do their job regardless of which party is in office. Now, this was not always the case. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, bring us the story of how a presidential assassination gave rise to the modern federal civil service.
On July 2nd, 1881, President James Garfield was about to board a train in Washington, D.C., when out of nowhere, he shot twice. The station erupts into chaos, and Garfield is lying on the train station floor.
Charles Guiteau, the man who shot President Garfield, is arrested right away at the train station.
He's immediately taken to a prison.
This is Candace Millard. She's the author of Destiny of the Republic.
He believed that God had chosen him for a great purpose. So he thinks that he helped Garfield win the White House.
Guiteau had delivered a single speech for Garfield's campaign. And when Garfield won the presidency, he believed he was owed a major government job in return. When he didn't receive it, he thought killing Garfield would make things right.
He was mentally ill and he was delusional. He believed very happily and vigorously in the spoils system.
The spoils system is exactly what it sounds like. It's the idea that whoever wins the presidency should be able to fill all those federal government jobs with people who are loyal. To the winner goes the spoils. So this meant that jobs like postman or tax collector weren't filled by the most qualified person, but instead the job was given out like a perk to party loyalists. It had been in use for decades at all levels of government.
But when the Civil War happened, suddenly the federal government grew exponentially to support the war effort. And there were a lot more jobs to be filled via the spoil system. The Republican Party, which controlled every branch of government at that point, used it to their advantage. But when the war ended, many people started to call the system out as corrupt and unfair. In fact,
within the Republican Party, you had this deep divide. There were the stalwarts.
Stalwarts.
Who believed that the spoils system was great and it made a lot of sense and they needed to protect it to keep it going.
And then there were what some people derisively called
half-breeds, who believed that it was essentially corrupt and needed to be reformed.
The term half-breed was an insulting way to describe someone of mixed Native and European descent. And the stalwarts used that term to insult Republicans who criticized the spoils system, meaning they were only half-Republican.
It's hard for Americans in the 21st century to understand how civil service reform could be like the number one issue at the top of the national agenda. But it was in the late 1870s.
This is
Scott Greenberger.
He's the executive editor of a news site called Stateline and has written extensively about this time in American politics. He says going into the 1880 election, the spoils system
was the major issue.
So the spoils system is on the top of everyone's minds at the 1880 Republican convention in Chicago. James Garfield, an Ohio House representative at the time, attends to give a speech in support of a presidential candidate that's against the spoils system. But then something unexpected happens. He gives an amazing speech and
someone in the crowd shouts, "We want Garfield!" And everybody just goes crazy. And Garfield suddenly finds himself the Republican nominee for president of the United States.
Garfield is in total shock.
Months later, Garfield wins the presidential election. And even though the Republicans and the country are still divided about the issue, he calls out the need to reform the spoils system in his inaugural speech.
The civil service can never be placed on a satisfactory basis until it is regulated by law.
But reform can take time. So from the first day he takes office, Garfield is faced with the spoils system. Every day, random people would walk into the White House and queue to ask the president for a job.
Say you want to be in charge of your post office in your little town, go to the White House and make your case to the president himself.
And Garfield hated it.
This is what made life hell, really, for Garfield when he was president. He specifically said, I don't know why anyone would ever want to be president.
And that's what brings us back to the man who shot President Garfield on July 2nd, 1881, a man named Charles Guiteau. He was one of these office seekers who wanted to keep the spoil system going.
Garfield ends up eventually dying from his bullet wounds, but his efforts to reform the civil service don't die with him. Chester Arthur, the vice president who assumed the presidency after Garfield's death, keeps the issue alive with the help of a Democratic Ohio senator.
George Pendleton was a prominent Democrat, but like some of the reform-minded Republicans, he opposed the spoil system.
He puts together a civil service reform bill that would come to be called the Pendleton Act. It did things like set up a test for all federal government job seekers.
At this time, it was a revolutionary idea. You get the government job because of your ability, not just party loyalty. The spoil system was so entrenched in American politics, it was going to be hard to pass this bill. But President Garfield's death galvanized a movement for reform that couldn't be stopped.
And shortly after, on January 16, 1883, a little over a year after Garfield's death, President Chester Arthur signed the Pendleton Act into law.
It was most definitely the beginning of the professional civil service that we have now. And in subsequent decades, they added civil service protections for more workers, and it grew and grew and grew.
At first, the Pendleton Act only covered about 10% of federal jobs, a few thousand federal workers. But as time went on, it expanded to eventually cover the vast majority of the federal workforce, which now measures in the millions.
These people who are professional civil servants, many of whom have been there for decades through administrations, Democratic and Republican, they serve the American people. They're not serving whoever happens to be in the White House. And they have expertise. And yes, they're supposed to be implementing the laws faithfully, but their jobs are not to advance the agenda of any party or a particular president.
Scott Greenberger, ending that short history of the modern federal civil service. You can hear more from Throughline's Rund Abdelfattah and Ramtin Arablouei wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
What? 6 o'clock already?
Yeah, man.
Get up. Oh, nerds. Thank you.